Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit BetterHelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
Welcome to ModPath Chat, the official podcast of Modern Pathology, featuring interviews with authors and experts on the latest science, technology, and developments in the field of pathology. Your host, Dr. George Netto, is the editor-in-chief of Modern Pathology and the chair of pathology at the University of Alabama at Birmingham. Here's Dr. Netto.
Welcome to ModPath Chat. Our guest today is Dr. Gladel Panner, professor of pathology and urology at the University of Chicago. Gladel is a prolific scholar with over 130 original publications and great contributions to the development of GU practice guidelines. That's his interest, especially lately. He currently leads the CAP cancer protocols panel for GU tumors. So if you have any qualms or issues with the checklist that you have to fill every day, Dr. Panner is your person to go to. Gladel and I will be discussing his recent publication in Modern Pathology on a controversial area of flat urothelial lesions, namely hyperplasia, dysplasia, atypia of unknown significance. What is the situation with these terminologies? Do they merit being entities or not? And that's part of a manuscript that he co-authored with several prestigious experts in the field, including Dr. Mahul Amin, who's the senior author, and Dr. Eva Compera. So thank you, Gladel, for accepting my invitation, and I look forward to this discussion.
Thank you, George, for the warm introduction, and thank you for inviting me to write this manuscript on this controversial intraurothelial lesions, and also for inviting me for this podcast. And I know that you yourself is a well-known expert in this area, so I'm really looking forward to this conversation.
I'm going to play the honest broker here. So that's my role as a podcast host. And then maybe afterward, we can duke it out on how we should call these. So it's going to be fun. But let's start with setting the stage by just talking how did these terminologies come about, a little bit on each of these entities. And more like in a historic perspective, how they keep evolving, dropping off, dropping in the WHO, and any analogies you can help our audience to understand what we're talking about.
So the concept of dysplasia or this premalignant lesions in the bladder is not a new thing. And actually, this the word dysplasia has been used way back in the 1980s already. And also the word hyperplasia, even before that, in the 1970s by Koss. And really, in terms of this classification, I think it's all started in the 1998 ISOP consensus, where this terminologies that includes this controversial flat hyperplasia, dysplasia, and the atypia of unknown significance was codified. And that was based on the paper 2 years prior that by Amin et al. And then subsequently, these entities was codified in the 2004 WHO, where they are actually, interestingly, in the WHO 2004, they were covered as separate chapters. There's devoted chapters for these entities. Now, the interesting thing is that in the 2000...
Which I want to explain to the audience. When something has a devoted chapter, that means that entity made it. rather than just being mentioned in introduction or under another chapter. So just to explain what you meant by that.
Oh, thank you, George. And then interestingly, in the 2016 WHO, there's a terminology change for flat hyperplasia, where it was lumped with the so-called papillary urethral hyperplasia. It's merged into what we was called as UPOMP, urethral proliferation of unknown malignant potential. And this was actually codified and made it to the list of tumors in the 2016. And also dysplasia was codified then. Now, fast forward, and I think this controversy really is timely, as it has ramification, and it went into the WHO 2022, if you allow me, George, to say it. So the controversy is there, and there's a major, major change in the new WHO, where dysplasia is now dropped in the list, and there's no chapter devoted to it, but it's mentioned there under the chapter of CIS. And also flat hyperplasia, which is basically part of UPOMP. The UPOMP is now dissolved, no longer part of the tumor list in the WHO 2022. So these are major changes. And you know, and the background of this is that, of course, there's controversy behind these entities.
Like always, you know, WHO classification meetings are that's not restricted to GU, of course, but it's always full of controversy. The good news is if you're looking at your table one, which I refer the authors to, you can see that we're having less and less entities and less nomenclatures, and things are dropping off. At the time of the publication, the 2022 was not yet published, but you alluded to, we don't even have dysplasia, we don't even have UPOMP. Some of us love that, but some are going back and discussing, so what are we going to do with these lesions? And I'm hoping today, with your masterful guidance, we're going to know exactly what to do with these lesions. And maybe by the time of 2026, we have some studies to show this is where we should settle. So
if I can add, George, to that, the interesting thing you mentioned about this, the longer list before is, before we used to stratify dysplasia, and now we contracted it into one, and this single entity now is even being questioned. What a change.
Correct. But there is irrational without that. It's not, I mean, these things don't happen just like any other field, just because whoever happens to be on that editorial board decided to drop. They usually try, the group try to do an honest, evidence-based why these things should move to an entity or drop as an entity. So let's focus on dysplasia and feel free even for the other two entities to describe how, when do you use these things, or even in the past, is there a criteria for each one, and at least in your own practice?
Yeah, so it's interesting that when dysplasia was introduced back in 1998, the definition hasn't changed, really. It's still the same. It's basically the cytologic and architectural features are felt to be neoplastic, but it's short of the threshold for CIS. But the problem there is the word felt. It kind of infuses subjectivity, and that's really the problem of dysplasia. And you know, dysplasia, as most experts will know, it has a problem in terms of reproducibility. But in terms of its usage, I personally use the diagnosis of dysplasia. And as we know, we encounter dysplasia primarily in the setting of secondary dysplasia. That is after the diagnosis of previous urothelial neoplasia. And then these are encountered usually on surveillance cystoscopy or RTUR after the diagnosis of urothelial neoplasia. Dysplasia rarely is encountered in the de novo setting. And the primary reason that it's not encountered is that because dysplasia has no clinical, they don't manifest with clinical symptoms. So that's why, you know, they are, when patients present with hematuria, usually they are more in the advanced stage, at least at the CIS level. So dysplasia is missed in the de novo. And a word of caution there is that when you are making a first-time diagnosis of dysplasia without a prior neoplasia, you have to be very cautious in making a diagnosis of de novo dysplasia, because these are usually encountered in the secondary setting wherein the patient already have a prior diagnosis of urothelial neoplasm, either papillary or CIS.
Correct. Very well said. So I like that. And this is a major problem that many of us have, a lesion that felt to be changes that are felt. You know, there's a lot of feelings in it and it falls short of CIS. And if we can, weigh in terms of why in the 2022, the consensus or the whatever, the idea that we went along with is this is not an entity if you're defining it by falling short of another entity. So we just talk about CIS, and in the chapter of CIS, we talk that if some people have used the term dysplasia, if they didn't feel 100% that the entity meets the criteria for CIS. So I think most people are on board that CIS is more reproducible, that the criteria is more solid. Of course, like anything else, is a spectrum. But people felt for dysplasia is even less so, and that was the rationale to drop it from having its own chapter. But I want to circle back to what you said. You were saying, you're right, there is no symptoms. That's why you don't diagnose dysplasia or catch it so many times. But in your paper, you talk about the new advances in cystoscopy, mainly blue light. And so you want to weigh in on that, because this is a very pertinent point.
Yeah. So these entities were introduced 3 decades ago, but, you know, we have advancement in our practice. So as George mentioned, first in our practice. Advancement in the cystoscopic techniques now with this narrow band imaging, and then the use of this blue light fluorescence, you know, so they may pick up these early lesions. And then of course the adoption of the surveillance protocols, you know, so for patients who have diagnosis with non-invasive papillary uterine carcinoma, they have they're under surveillance protocol for at least 5 years and yearly cystoscopy. So early lesions can be picked up in that. And then the third is that there's also a change in the practice in that now it's standard to do a TUR, repeat TUR or restaging TUR for high-grade non-invasive papillary uterine carcinoma. And in the process of restaging, early phase of the lesion may also be captured by that procedure. And also, George, there's also advancement, as you know, in the understanding of the genomics of urothelial mucosa. And now we, especially in the genomics in field defects, this clonal proliferation of normal appearing urothelium that may have some molecular alterations there. And of course, you know, the changes in the transformation to malignancy. So, you know, so with this new knowledge and advancement in the technique of detection, so, you know, maybe it's time, you know, it's really pertinent to reappraise our understanding of these lesions. Of course, as I like to emphasize that we are really kind of working on limited data. And that's been the problem, limited data on these entities. And not only that, but it's hard to extrapolate all these data through the years because of the changing criteria. And then, of course, the variability in the interpretation or the diagnosis of these entities.
Very well said. So you kind of touch upon, because this is an article that we, in this series of controversies in pathology, where we try to invite authors from both sides of the argument and where they put the pros and cons. The idea is that these entities need further studies, and hopefully this will these series of controversies will lead to more better evidence down the road. But in the article, for every one of these entities, you eloquently list the pros for keeping that terminology and the cons for that terminology. And so you touched a little bit about dysplasia by saying, you know, the pros is now there's early detection. Can you, by this blue light, for example, so you're discovering lesions that would have not been discovered, and those maybe have that morphologic features. So that kind of give you a place to go to, right, in between. What other pros for having the diagnosis of dysplasia?
So the other pros is, one is, of course, as I mentioned, potential saliency with the new techniques. The other is that, and we have not covered about this, and this may have some ramification of the way we diagnose dysplasia, is that the adoption of this morphologic analogy with the papillary tumors, which is really, personally, I really like this analogy because it simplifies things. And to kind of briefly describe it, is basically the papillary and the flat lesions are analogous in terms of morphology. That if you have a high-grade papillary carcinoma as a papillary lesion, the flat counterpart morphologically will be CIS. And then the low-grade papillary urothelial carcinoma as a papillary lesion, as a flat lesion, it will be the dysplasia morphologically. And then the pun lump, as a papillary lesion, has a hyperplasia appearing urothelium, and in a flat lesion, it's analogous to basically hyperplasia, flat hyperplasia. So I really like this analogy. Now, going back to one of the pros of using dysplasia, so this, George, there's no data on this, but this might help us kind of enhance our reproducibility. I don't know, but the fact that we accept low-grade papillary urothelial carcinoma to a certain degree of reproducibility as an entity using the same morphologic criteria, so we may be able to extrapolate this morphological reproducibility of low-grade papillary carcinoma and extrapolate it to dysplasia. So, you know, of course, there's no data on this, but this is a recent change. And there's a promise there, at least from the morphologic diagnosis. Now, another pros, but this is really kind of a limited, is that there are old studies, and I'm talking here about studies like about 20 years ago, which followed de novo dysplasia, and there's really progression to carcinoma, I think around 14 to 19% of those de novo dysplasia. But, you know, I mean, these are older studies, so this is like there's a scholarship gap here. And, you know, and for our young audience or, you know, interested in doing research, this is going to be a gap, you know, that have to fill. So there's really a scholarship gap here. So, and of course, George, the other thing that, you know, for the concept of dysplasia, the concept of dysplasia is well accepted in other organs. You know, we know that there's squamous dysplasia, glandular dysplasia. Why not in the bladder? Why not in the urothelium? And there should be, you know, cancer should start somewhere, right? They should start somewhere. So there, it should be also there in the bladder, having, you know, so it sets the other organ dysplasia sets precedence for the bladder acceptance as well. And of course, one is that it's kind of really more on the practical side, is that if we have a diagnosis of dysplasia, then it has this buffer diagnosis, right? If you have only like normal and then you have CIS, then it is, there's this borderline buffer category. Interestingly, one study actually review the diagnosis of dysplasia by non-expert pathologists, and they changed the diagnosis to CIS in about 1/5 of the cases, and that's significant. So that's kind of helpful in a way, you know, for the diagnosis. So those
you can argue. I mean, you can argue if 20% are reclassified, that's a problem. But we'll come to the cons. But very well said, and that's exactly why this terminology endures, even if it's, as I mentioned, under CIS. But it's you hit the point, and I fully agree with you. The audience allow me, because it's an area that I practice every day. My own practice is. When I used to call dysplasia, I don't call dysplasia anymore. So I'm more in tune with the 2022. But I say that I'm worried about something, neoplastic lesion, and I give a descriptive. I either call CIS or benign reactive. And then for the in-between, I don't use the dysplasia as escape, but it's a very legitimate argument. But for especially what you mentioned about the analogy, I think this is a good starting point to tell people, if these cytologic changes equate with what you call low-grade papillary, those are the ones in the flat lesion that you should. And if those were on a papillary lesion enough to call it high-grade, then you should call it CIS. So I think it's a very good starting point, but will remain to see if this become more reproducible that way. And if that becomes more importantly, has clinical ramification, because as you mentioned, especially in the secondary dysplasias, those could be residual shoulder lesions, right? So you want to touch upon the cons, starting with the shoulder the lesions issues.
In relation to that, regarding the cons, so because it's a shoulder lesion, it's encountered in the de novo setting, so that's really questioned the clinical actionability of finding dysplasia, what to do with it if we see it. So, the patients, first of all, the patients is put on surveillance protocol because of an earlier diagnosis of carcinoma. So they're really being followed based on that finding. So the finding of dysplasia during the interim will not really alter any the management for that patient. And dysplasia can be seen in the RTUR as the edge of a prior dissected high-grade or even low-grade papillary urothelial carcinoma, and that's not an uncommon scenario. And actually, it's actually also a pros, if you will, because it tells you that you are sampling the residual lesion by finding dysplasia in the prior TUR site. Although, as a con, that this finding really doesn't have a clinical meaning.
Correct, because this is not a new lesion. You're just resecting the residual lesions.
Yes. And if you want me to go further about the cons, George, so I think really what the major con for the dysplasia is the reproducibility. And that's really a big problem. And it's interesting that when we're going through this, writing this manuscript, we have to review the previous publication, and we were looking at the images. We ourselves as authors, kind of arguing, no, that's CIS. Kind of. Yeah, so we cannot, it's just interesting that we ourselves cannot, are kind of questioning the previous images. And so that's one. And when it comes to the diagnosis of dysplasia, we are really limited to the morphologic diagnosis. And we don't have any ancillary studies to use. One study actually used this panel of CK20, the usual P53 and CD44, but they found actually that in the setting of dysplasia, it's not that helpful. What's actually helpful as a predictive for prognostication is the patient's prior history of papillary urothelial neoplasia, not the findings of that immunohistochemical panel. So we really don't have ancillaries. And then even for looking for molecular alterations, as I already alluded to earlier, molecular alteration can also be present or identified in normal appearing urothelium. So we're putting ourselves on a risk here. If we use molecular alteration as a evidence of dysplasia, we're putting ourselves on a risk here that we might be seeing, say, a reactive urothelium with molecular alteration. Then we may overdiagnose it as dysplasia. So that's another con. And other factors is that, it's rare for de novo dysplasia to be diagnosed. Because of course, as I alluded to earlier, de novo dysplasia don't present with symptoms. So, so if we're having an entity that is rarely identified, in bladder cancer, I said, unlike colonic cancer, there's a screening, where we can pick up these pre-malignant lesions. In the bladder, we don't have a screening cystoscopy. So we might miss this dysplasia. We won't be able to diagnose this de novo dysplasia in the bladder. So that's another con for dysplasia. And lastly, in the setting of secondary dysplasia, as already mentioned, is that there's really, it doesn't really change the management if this is identified during surveillance. In the surveillance setting, patients with prior neoplasia, because the management is already being dictated by the previous diagnosis of urothelial neoplasia.
Amazing. You mentioned every single one that you wrote in the paper. You memorized the paper. I hope you reviewed it yesterday. That's not how your memory is, because that's really intimidating. You're amazing, Gladel. You're doing great to the field. And to leave our audience with something now that we confuse them enough, and for our audience, the confusion is just Right now, you're like us. We're confused about, we don't agree with each other. We don't agree with ourselves when we call dysplasia versus CIS sometimes. And that was the rationale for my approach is I'm not going to stick a neoplastic diagnosis, especially in a primary setting, if I'm not 100% sure. And so that's how I use the escape. I describe atypical urothelial, cannot rule out CIS, which... A piece that we need to mention is how you communicate to your urologist. Exactly. And your local urologist will know what you mean. And as long as they know this is what I mean, this could be that old dysplasia, or last month I used to call it dysplasia, or this could be CIS, go ahead and do what you have to do. I think that's extremely important. But can you share with the audience what the group of authors, including yourself, left in the paper, what the recommendation for clinical practice right now, and how you would approach it or you recommend is a decent option or two of how to address these lesions?
So, some of us, make a diagnosis of dysplasia, and the dysplasia, the vagus is mostly in the secondary setting, and we're very cautious, and I advise the audience also to be very cautious in making a diagnosis of de novo dysplasia. Now, there's some problem with reproducibility of dysplasia, but we believe that there are also dysplasia, bona fide dysplasia cases that can be diagnosed, and these have changes that are that are subtle or mild, mild disorganization, mild loss of polarity, mild nuclear changes, mitosis is not that high. And they don't have these features, and this is very important, is to make a distinction that they are not, they are less than what is you have to make a diagnosis of CIS. And for CIS, that's different. You have Markley, morphism, brisk mitotic activity, florid nucleomegaly, et cetera. Now, since, dysplasia is controversial, very controversial, it's difficult to diagnose, our advice is that when you're making dysplasia, a diagnosis of dysplasia, check first the history, make sure that you're in the secondary setting. That's kind of gives you more space to wiggle, that you're probably you are allowed to diagnose a dysplasia at that setting. And then second, since this is controversial, and there's some issue with the reproducibility, we advise to show it, it's better to show it to another colleague or maybe in a consensus, a department consensus meeting to before you render the diagnosis of dysplasia. And of note, as I mentioned earlier, we don't have ancillary aid to make a diagnosis of dysplasia. So don't use immunostains to make a distinction between dysplasia or CIS because it's not going to be helpful.
Very helpful. So with that note, it's just I want to wrap it up and saying the good news is in the secondary setting, and that's why you're being liberal in the secondary setting, is not going to affect the management because the management is dictated by the prior diagnosis. It's in the primary setting that is because you're hinting this person may have CIS or may progress to CIS, it's a bigger deal. So that's where you have to be even extra, extra cautious. And maybe you choose to just admit and give it a descriptive and say, I'm worried about CIS, wait till the inflammation subside, repeat the biopsy. So the ramification, clinical ramification, if people follow the approach that you just described, will be non-harmful and hopefully will, by using the analogy to low-grade papillary, maybe we can have some better criteria going forward. Then maybe one day we'll bring it back as a chapter to the WHO.
Yeah, hopefully. Yeah, it's interesting, George, if you allow me to quote, this is a study by my co-author, Stephen Smith. So we basically surveyed about 45 experts at GU Pathology internationally, 45. And it's interesting that 83% endorse the concept of dysplasia, that it's relevant to the pathogenesis. Relevant, it exists to the pathogenesis. But only a little bit more than half endorse it for use in clinical practice. So there's the divide, So, right. So and I think overall, George, writing this pros and cons, and when I process this, I ended up I'm stuck in the middle, really, about this. So I think the decision of the WHO 2022 to habit removed, I think it's fair at this point. And I think it's fair to say that we really need additional studies on dysplasia. And for the audience who are listening right now, they are young colleagues. The studies that we need is especially in the setting of de novo dysplasia to understand this more, you know, not only about its, diagnostic setting, but also in, you know, in the molecular, in the scientific concept of dysplasia, basically.
Well, thank you very much. It's been a pleasure to have you as our guest today. And I'm sure we're going to have you again for other controversial issues. I'm hinting to our recent meeting in prior to the European Society Congress of Pathology, where there was a whole day about ISUP looking at the grading of papillary lesions and the topic we just talked about. So I'm sure more publications will follow. We'll be pleased to have you and your co-authors back. So long, everyone.
Thank you.
Any opinions expressed in this podcast are the speaker's own and do not represent the views of Modern Pathology, Springer Nature, UAB, or USCAP. Your ModPath Chat host and scientific director is Dr. George Netto. Producers are Christina Crow, Amber Jackson, Dr. Sarah Jang, and Dr. Catherine Ketchum. Technical direction is provided by Kaminsky Productions, music by Mitch Neubauer. Thanks to the authors, reviewers, and editors of Modern Pathology for making this podcast possible.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Kyler Tsedis.
I'm Kayla Tsinas, and I have been training a global community of women since 2009. I've created a brand new podcast, Sweat Daily, to help you level up your life and reach your health and well-being goals. From fitness tips to food that fuels you, meditation to motivation, we've got you covered. Sweat Daily, the happiest, healthiest, and most confident version of you awaits. Available on Apple Podcasts and wherever you get your podcasts.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.